terrible that day. We all rolled us like that. And me, personally, because I turned myself in when the cops were looking for me in 1980 to go do 25 years. So I ain't no risk fight. Right.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Hello, all you wiretappers out there. We're here in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown Kansas City with my good friend Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Tonight, you know, we're in the Black Hand Month. We'll designate here the latter part of April, May as Black Hand Month around here. We mentioned Lupo the Wolf. What a cool name. What a badass name that would be to be known as Lupo the Wolf on the streets, huh, Aaron? What would be your street name, Aaron? Aaron the Gnerk?
No, I thought it was The Blade.
Oh, that's right, The Blade. Aaron, the Blade. That's right, we did say that. Aaron the Blade.
Not because of my...
And you forgot The Blade that one night you got robbed. But
yeah, no, I was not. I don't normally carry a blade. I don't know why. The only reason people would call me with The Blade is because I cut people with my words.
Yeah. Anyhow, Lupo the Wolf. His real name is unpronounceable, basically, but we're going to... He has a shortened term... He has a shortened version of it, Ignacio Saeta, or Lupo, Lupo the Wolf. He was a Sicilian-American black hand leader in New York City in the early 1900s.
Now, wait a second.
What?
Did you have a, what was your nickname back in the day?
Oh, well, they called me a variety of things, mainly Jinx. One point in time, I was
Jinx
called the Goat.
Jinx?
Jinx, J-E-N-K-S, or it would be J-I-N-X, I don't know. At one time, I worked in a little squad. The one guy nicknamed me the Goat because he said I was always kind of rumpled looking in my detective suit. Back when I was a young, first started being a detective, and I had kind of a rumpled suit a lot. And he said I looked like I was all rumpled up like a goat. So he started calling me the Goat.
Yeah, I wouldn't let that stick.
It didn't stick. It did not stick.
I'd rather be known as the Jinx.
You never know. Sometimes you don't have a say-so in those nicknames. I'm trying to think of some of the other nicknames. There was Vito. We had a guy we worked with. Everybody nicknamed him Vito, although his real name had nothing to do with Vito. He wasn't Italian. He wasn't anything. That he just was this big, tough guy that really bore down on those mob guys in Kansas City, so everybody called him Vito. And when we called Lee Boy... I don't know why we called him Lee Boy. We just called him Lee Boy. Who knows? Sometimes you don't know why people get their nicknames. Kind of like Tony Ripe, Savella. I don't know why he got the nickname Ripe or Tony Ripe. His first name was Anthony, but he got the nickname Ripe.
You don't know why Ignacio got the Wolf.
Well, Lupo the Wolf. Maybe we'll find out if we look into him. Let's see. Let's examine him. He was a bad dude. You know, he ran extortion operations, which we know. Robberies, loan sharking, murder. You know, those black handers were always extorting money from other Italian immigrants. That's why Joe Petrosino and locally we had Officer Raimo and Olivero, both of whom were, all three of those officers were killed by black handers. By the turn of the century, Lupo had formed a crew. He'd merged his crew with other crews in the South Bronx and East Harlem. They formed the first crime family, the Morello crime family, which became the leading mafia family in New York City and right after the turn of the century. He was suspected of at least 60 murders, but he was not caught or even had, the authorities didn't pay much attention to him until 1910. Now, Joe Petrosino did, but if you remember, The bulk of the cops were Irish, and all the criminal justice system were Irish, and they were not paying much attention to black handers and black hand crime.
Well, most of that crime was sort of like Italians and Sicilians committing crimes on each other.
Right. Now here's an interesting fact. If you remember, there was no, Stephen said there was no FBI, but there was the only federal law enforcement was the Secret Service. And you see, these guys, these early mob guys, they quickly learned to go across state lines and city outside of cities. So the cities back then, the cities had their own police department, and you had the state patrol. Well, the state patrol was mainly a rural kind of group of policemen that patrolled the highways. They didn't really do a lot of crime stuff because there wasn't any crime out in the country. So these guys figured that out, and they moved out in the country. The Secret Service got onto this guy, and they caught him running a large-scale counterfeiting ring up in the Catskill Mountains. Convicted him. He served 10 years, a 30-year sentence, and was eventually forced into retirement as the modern-day National Crime Syndicate came on and kind of displaced all the old mustache Petes. The ones they didn't kill, they basically squeezed on out when Lucky Luciano, and he kind of merged. He merged with Jewish gangsters like Mayor Lansky and Jimmy Blue Eyes Allo and Frank Costello and people like that wanted to be more sophisticated. They got into gambling, and Prohibition came along, and they squeezed out the old, really unpopular in the Italian community, mustache Pete's. Lupo the Wolf was born in Palermo, Sicily. The name Lupo means wolf in Italian. So Lupo the Wolf literally translates to Wolf the Wolf. It's an interesting little wordplay, isn't it?
Not Wolf the Wolf.
His actual surname was Lupo originally. He was often referred to by his mother's maiden name, which was Ignazio Saita. But his real name was Lupo Saita. Started out working in a dry goods store in Palermo when he was 10 years old. By the time he got to the United States, early on, 1898, he shot and killed a business rival named Salvatore Morello, who, according to Lupo, he shot him in self-defense after Morello attacked him with a dagger during an argument in Lupo's store. Lupo had a dry goods store. This was over in Sicily. Lupo went into hiding after the killing, and probably this was a older black hander in Sicily that was trying to extort money from Lupo's dry goods store over there. He fled Italy to escape prosecution for this murder. He stopped in Liverpool, Montreal, and finally arrived in New York City in 1898. In 1899, after he had gotten to the United States, Lupo was convicted in absentia of willful and deliberate murder for the murder of Salvatore Morello. Reportedly, it was other clerks that worked in his store who had worked for him testified against him. He would never return to Sicily. Once he got to New York City, Lupo opened a store on East 72nd Street in Manhattan with his cousin. Shortly after that, they had a disagreement, and he moved his business to Brooklyn. Moved back to Manhattan later on and opened another store, so he's kind of involved in a variety of different small businesses.
Now, was that area of Manhattan they considered Little Italy?
Probably 9 Prince Street. I'm not sure. Prince. I think that would probably be over there by Mulberry Street in Little Italy, because there's probably, you certainly couldn't open a business and particularly not a saloon, because he opened a saloon at the same time in any place but Little Italy. I'd have to look that up on a map, but I would imagine. His father came to New York City a little later, and they, together, they became the Black Hand in the United States, and they started preying on other Italian immigrants.
So Ignazio worked with his father, but was he working with anybody else?
You know, I mentioned that he eventually threw in with some other people and started the Morello crime family. Now, I don't want to confuse you. He killed a guy named Salvatore Morello, but Morello is not that uncommon a name in Sicily. In 1902, a man named Giuseppe Morello bought a saloon right down the street. Actually, I got the address on that. If you live in New York City, go check. Is there an 8, number 8, Prince Street? And that's at the rear of the premises where Lupo was running his saloon. So they were both running a saloon. Morello had immigrated to the United States from Sicily in the 1890s, and he had been joined by his three brothers, half-brothers, Vincenzo Terranova, Ciro Terranova, and Nicholas Morello. Lupo became closely associated with these brothers, the Morello Terranova faction, they called it. And eventually he married into their immediate family, and he wed Salvatrice Terranova, one of the Ciro and Vincenzo's sister, in 1903. And he maintained his leadership over his Little Italy-based interest, and he eventually merged with the Morello Terranova faction and became the Morello crime family. Now, connected with this crime family, the Morello's half-brothers, the Terranovas, ran rackets with other soldiers like Giuseppe Fenaro, Giuseppe Joe Cantania Sr., Charles Ubriaco, and Tomasano the Ox Pedo. I bet he was a big dude. What do you want to think? The Ox was a top enforcer and killer within this crime family. Lupo demanded absolute obedience from the members of his crew. He was so bad that, and this would be really unusual in modern times in the La Cosa Nostra National Crime Syndicate style of mafia, but in the Black Hand days, I guess family members were not off limits. One time, Lupo was so mad at one of his guys that was not doing what he said that he killed one of his relatives just because he merely suspected a guy was being a traitor. His reputation was so fearsome that it was common for Italian immigrants to cross themselves at the mention of his name. He was suspected of at least 60 murders, I think I said that before, and probably killed even more. He was a suspect in the killing on July the 23rd, 1903, of Giuseppe Joseph Cantania, and on April 14th, 1903, the barrel murder of Madania Benedetto. He was never caught until they caught him. The Secret Service caught him in 1910 running this counterfeiting ring in his Catskills. He went in the penitentiary. He was granted parole on June the 30th, 1920. Came back to New York.
I wonder how many years he was running the counterfeiting ring, because that certainly would have made his financial outlook a lot better. I mean, sure, he had like an import store and a saloon, and he rented the back of the saloon space to some other guys, and then he sets up an operation outside of town printing money.
Yeah. Well, he was committing these murders, like, and he was becoming the boss of his own family, like 1903, 1904, 1905, and he was arrested in 1910 and went to the penitentiary for 20 years. So he ran that for 8 or 9 years, more than likely, for quite a while.
But once they caught him, convicted him, sent him to jail, now is he running the family from inside the prison?
No, he just, he's out of it for this period of time. But he still stays connected. Because when he comes out and he's on parole, he wants to take a trip to Italy. He claimed it was for the kind of generic purposes of business, and it's very important. It would be a brief trip. In October of 1921, probably some political chips got called in. Warren Harding, the president, freed Lupo from the constraints of his parole by granting a conditional commutation of sentence. A report of the Attorney General that year, and actually in 1922, the next year, said that Lupo wanted to return to Italy and had stated that his co-defendant in the counterfeiting ring, Giuseppe Morello, had already gotten a commutation of his sentence just 8 years after he went into prison. So they let him go. They let him go to Italy.
Which seems odd, because he had already had an outstanding warrant for killing another Morello over there.
Really? And here's kind of interesting. The conditions of his commutation sentence, that he remain law-abiding and not connected with any unlawful undertaking during the period of the sentence. The president himself would be the sole judge of whether the condition was ever violated, and if it ever was, he would declare the commutation null and void. In such circumstance, the president would order Lupo arrested and returned to prison to serve out the remainder of his sentence. Well, ain't that something? Now, think about that. It'd be like if President Trump were to commute somebody's sentence and then say, okay, this guy's going to get out, but he has to remain law-abiding, but I'm the one that says if he remains law-abiding or not. Well, I tell you, the news people would go nuts on that one, wouldn't they? I smell there's a rat in this deal here. There's some political payoffs going on here. I don't know what it is. It reached all the way up to the president of the United States. He tried to go back into business, but by the 1930s, we had this, as I talked before, the emerging National Crime Syndicate with Lucky Luciano and Frank Costello, and they did not like the old black hand ways. They called Lupo the Wolf in for a meeting, and they told him he generated too much heat, and he had to give up all of his rackets. He allowed him to keep a small lottery in Brooklyn, which was mainly played by poor Italian shopkeepers and pushcart laborers and pushcart operators and people like that. Lupo had always relied entirely on violence and terror, while the new National Crime Syndicate, the new mob, wanted to use bribery first.
Yeah, so why would Lupo even pay attention to these guys since he's not answering to them?
Well, they were, by then, they're in charge.
They had consolidated all their power, sure.
Right, and they were more powerful than he was. He didn't really have a choice. I bet he probably continued to do stuff, but he had to keep it on the down low. He did, on his own, he did continue. He formed a protection racket involving bakers in New York City. I would imagine he would go around to bakery shops and say, you know, I sure would hate to see a stink bomb get thrown in here. I sure would hate to see you have a fire one night, and get each one of them, give him a little bit of money, and so that would, you know, that would kind of keep him going. He drew some heat because in 1936, in the early 30s, in the middle 30s, the New York governor, that man named Herbert Lehman, petitioned Franklin Roosevelt, the new president, to have Lupo returned to prison for racketeering. And he was returned to the federal prison in Atlanta to serve the last few years of his original counterfeiting sentence. So I guess they called back in. This is kind of a loosey-goosey way to do things. Like 20 years later, he's been out on this commutation, this weird kind of commutation, and they bounce him back on the original counterfeiting sentence. He wasn't out on parole particularly.
Well, he had a
if he had been, he had been off of parole by now, but he was on this commutation, which seemed to go on forever. I never heard anything like that. So the next few years serving out the original counterfeiting sentence, and he only had, I think, about 8 or 10 years left to go on that. Finally, he was released during the war, and he died unnoticed, basically, in 1947. They're all, the four Morello Terranova brothers and Lupo, are all buried at Calvary Cemetery in Queens, New York, not far from Joe Petrosino. I think we mentioned already with Stephen Taltry that the cemetery where Petrosino has a nice big monument paid for by the people of New York City, most of the mob guys in that era that he was battling all the time are also buried there.
Be a good one for your app.
Yeah, well, if we had an app in New York City. There is an app for a mob tour of New York City, actually. One I based mine on. I didn't do it exactly like theirs, but I bought it and kind of based on how they did theirs. So that's just a little extra story about we didn't cover in very much detail when we talked about Joe Petrosino. We have to go back, do a little more research on some of these other black handers. They're kind of they didn't get near the publicity and kind of been lost to history, just like Joe Petrosino was compared to Frank Costello. And
I wonder if Stephen Talty's book, The Black Hander, includes information about Ignacio.
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about it. It will, because he was probably one of his arch enemies. You know, Aaron, there is, you ask about his book, and there's not a lot of books out there about the Black Handers, but there is a movie out there called Pay or Die. It was filmed and released in 1960. Ernest Borgnine plays the lead, and they talk about Joe Petrosino and some of the different black-handers in those days. And in Italian or Sicilian, it's La Mano Nera, or the black hand. N-E-R-A is probably black, and M-A-N-A would be hand.
So they didn't refer to themselves as the black-handers in English.
No.
That was just the anglicizing of the Italian
right.
term.
Yeah, this film is a dramatization of Joseph Petrosino, and it primarily deals with his Italian squad's opposition to the extortion of shopkeepers in Manhattan's Little Italy. I have to try to find that. It'll be kind of a fun one to watch. Now, I assume Ernest Borgnine must play Joe Petrosino. If Leonardo DiCaprio plays Joe Petrosino, then he will be found in the footsteps of Ernest Borgnine.
Here, according to Wikipedia, there's a page for him. It says, in popular culture, also the character of Don Fanucci in The Godfather Part II is based on Ignazio Lupo.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that. Well, he had a pretty colorful nickname. He was, everybody remembered, he must have been a bad dude. You know, I mentioned about the Barrow murders. The Barrow murders were made famous by the Provenzano crime family in New Orleans, but they were then adopted by this newly formed Morello crime family with Lupo the Wolf. And what they did, they would kill people and then stuff them inside a barrel of sawdust body, and eventually they started finding some of the bodies. Oh, here's a picture of a body stuffed in. It's a 1903 picture of a barrel murder crime scene.
You would think as a importer exporter he would be able to get rid of those barrels.
You would think so.
Not just store them somewhere.
You know, his time when he went back into prison, actually when he first went into prison in 1910, he was in trouble the whole time. First, right off the bat, he tried to bribe a prison guard to mail out unauthorized letters. They kept putting him in solitary confinement, and they used to do something called a restricted diet. He got in trouble for antagonizing other inmates. He would be making hand signs, which were, you know, they could communicate without the prison guards knowing what they were saying. That was against the rules. He always kept getting him for disorderly conduct, spitting on the prison floor. He kept putting him back and restricting his diet. Oh, here's one thing he did. He got 5 days in solitary confinement and a restricted diet for renumbering his prison uniform. 1916, the Deputy Warden Brock of the Atlanta Penitentiary is murdered by inmates. Lupo is questioned about his involvement in the crime. He denies even knowing about the murder, but other witness inmates place him 6 feet away when the crime was committed. He supposedly knew about the plot and even positioned himself to witness the slaughter, which tells me this is the kind of guy that actually paid somebody to do it. But he was never charged with that crime. He did go back to Italy for a while after he got out of the first prison sentence. He was detained by immigration and released after convincing them he was nothing but a wine importer. When he came back, he established himself back in the mafia life, but he never really got back, like we said earlier.
We might have to do something on Giuseppe, the clutch hand Morello.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We'll have to do that. He's probably part of that crew, isn't he?
Giuseppe, the clutch hand Morello. That's a good name. That's a good mob name.
You know, this Lupo the Wolf, by the end, in 1930, that's when they sent him back to prison for that, to finish up that final part of his sentence. He had started extorting from local Italian bakeries. That's what I thought. I mean, the other thing said that he was set up some kind of protection racket with Italian bakeries, and he even murdered a bakery owner, Roger Casilio.
To try to convince him that he really was protecting
him. He was back, yes. Yeah. He is back. Here's what a newspaper said about him when he went into prison. Atlanta penitentiary gates clanged yesterday on Ignazio Lupo the Wolf Saeta, oldest living public enemy in the United States. The grizzled mafia terrorist, now in his 60th year and reputed to have banked in Italy more than $3 million gleaned from New York rackets, was returned to prison on a warrant signed by President Roosevelt. July 16th, 1936.
You know, for a guy who sold olive oil, cheese, and wine, he seemed to be pretty well connected.
He did. He did. He lost it by the 30s, but he had it during the turn of the century until the Secret Service. You know, I was like, the Secret Service was the only thing they probably were afraid of back then, the local police, except for Joe Petrosino's little squad. And even if back then you could buy off the judge, you could buy off the prosecutor, you could bribe jurors, there was a lot of things that could be done. Even with, you know, one good, dedicated, untouchable squad, there was a lot of corruption in the whole criminal justice system, really up until, in every large city, up until, I'd say, the middle to later 1950s, and that's when it started changing.
Here's some interesting information I found in a Google search on him. It says here, I want to quote the site. I think it's La Cosa Nostra database. It's lacndb.com. And interesting, in the description, it gives his birthplace as Corleone, Sicily. I don't know if we had said that. But they have some additional information here that we didn't talk about, which is the murder stables. Lupo reportedly owned a property known as the Murder Stables. In these horrific stables, numerous of rivals were said to have been killed and tortured. Much of this appears to be gang legend, although it is believed there could have been such a stable because Lupo did own one. Whether or not it existed, it did give Lupo an enormous and fearful reputation. In 1906, Lupo was arrested in connection with the kidnapping of Tony Bonzuffi, the son of a baker. The Morello Terranova Saeta criminal group was active in black hand extortion and protection rackets, counterfeiting, smuggling, and forgery. One of their early associates was Vito Cassio Ferro. Vito Cassio Ferro, who spent some years in New York before going back to the old country where he would rise to become boss of bosses.
That stables, that's probably where they stuffed people in the sawdust back barrels, but then didn't get rid of all the bodies. You know, another, think about it, Mad Sam. Remember Mad Sam DeStefano?
Mm-hmm.
He supposedly had a soundproof basement that he liked to take people down there and torture, and that was a famous story in Chicago mob lore back in the day. So I think all these guys like to have some kind of a story like that. Kind of it takes a lot of problems out of enforcing your will on people when they think that you're that bad and you got that kind of place that you're going to take somebody and torture and murder them. Trying to think, in Kansas City, the closest thing we had to it would probably be Willie Camisano's garage. Well, I just heard a funny story about that today. Willie Camisano was a mob guy, and he killed a guy named David Bonadonna. Well, just prior to that, the FBI had two targets they wanted to put a microphone in. They had Willie Camisano's garage, and they had the offices of a cleaning service, both places where mob guys hung out. They decided that the garage was probably not that good a target, and they thought they'd go to this other place and the cleaning service office, and it came up dry. There was not one conversation. Well, during the next 30 days, David Bonadonna was killed inside that garage. If they'd have gone the other way, it was just a fluke. They could have gone either way. They had probable cause either way to install the microphone. If they'd gone the other way, I was kidding that with Bill that, you know, like that monitoring agent would be sitting there and be going, come here a minute. And he'd rewind the tape, say, listen to that. What was that? I don't know. Sound like a gunshot to me. Oh, now there's a car backing out. Why don't you think it was? Oh, he probably just dropped something on the floor. So that would have been something to had that wire or that microphone running and the tape running when they killed that guy. That's almost as good as the Bureau taped a induction ceremony back in Boston a few years ago. I just posted that up on my Facebook page, a link to the site that has that. They don't really have the audio, but they've got a transcription of it. Well, if you've got a friend or relative with a problem, with drugs or alcohol or any kind of addiction, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I've got to say folks need to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City while you listen to the podcast, and then get the book, Leaving Vegas.
A true story of how FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos. And my new book, just subscribe, you'll get a free book, The Surveillance Stories, by subscribing to my website.
Hear it from the mouth of the men that did it in the Kindle version of Leaving Vegas, or in the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for purchase on Amazon.
Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Facebook at Odd-O-Matic Music.
On the advice of my lawyer, I respectfully refuse to answer that question, as my truthful answer may tend to incriminate me.